of the famous contact scene in Flying Saucers have landed, he observed. When I got to the beautiful young man with the silken hair, I could not go on reading. This sounds ridiculous to me, like a fairy tale. Since Jung's great gift to mankind was a deep analysis of the meaning, function, and psychoanalysis of the fairy tale, this remark is surprising. It is certain that Adamski restructured his belief system, as represented originally by his self-published fictional book Pioneers in Space, to try and make it work off the page into life itself. When this happens in the laboratory, men and women get the Nobel Prize. When it happens within the software of pure vision, they are usually vilified, accused of cheating, fraud and exploitation. It is the difference between someone writing about fairies and saying they saw one in a wood. Our culture has lost entirely Jung's idea of an intermediate state between the two. In this sense, literature itself is all about a form of purely natural mind control. As long as things don't spill out of the culture dish, we can safely enjoy ourselves. It is likely that Adamski went from fiction to fact not in an attempt to deceive, so much as to create. The transparently honest Lucy McGuinness, Adamski's secretary for many years, saw this process in action. She told Timothy Good that, indeed, she was worried by the similarities between Adamski's earlier fictional work, Pioneers of Space, and the factual work inside the spaceships. She added, "It never bothered me to the extent that I made an issue of it, because, you see, I could have made an issue of it if I hadn't seen those ships." This triangulation between almost fiction and almost fact, with personal experience in between, makes up a rare moment regarding individual identity and cultural formation. On one hand, McGuinness is aware of a book that was cast as fiction. On the other hand, she is aware of another later book in which that fiction has been edited as fact. The two sides of this equation would cancel themselves out if she had not seen the ships with her own eyes. It is as if the ships were made of the very flow of information from the first book to the second. If Jung had been more patient and looked more closely, he of all people would have detected that process within the whole Adamski affair. Lucy McGuinness was privileged to see such a complete triangulation between almost fact, almost fiction and uncompromising personal visionary experience. The British writer Nick Pope, who was in charge of UFO investigations for the Ministry of Defence, is a more recent author who has experienced such a triangulation. He went from being a hard Ministry of Defence man into a kind of no man's land, then onto pure fiction, with rumours of his own abduction in between. Thus 50 years later, Pope, like Adamski, travelled through all three information dimensions with the bonus of a claim as equally fantastic as that of Adamski. After a few weeks, Adamski was invited back to Detroit. This time, despite bad weather, he filled 4,700 seats of the 5,000-seat Masonic Temple, which was festooned with banners bearing his name. But again, his performance was disappointing. He had never had any training in this business of proper public presentation, as the PR man had yet to arrive properly on the historical stage. Also, the halls in those days were just halls. They had practically nothing of today's modern sound systems, and even fewer audio-visual presentation aids. America at this time was still very much a hailing distance culture, and Adamski appeared nervous and ill-prepared. As was not uncommon in those days, the single complicated projector was nowhere near powerful enough to properly present films and slides to a mass audience. Things were not improved by Adamski's lack of knowledge about how to present himself and his material to such a large public audience. At this stage in his life, he had no proper assistant in attendance, no manager, and no personal presentation advisor. According to Brian Treve, Adamski's insistence on reading out in full a long and complicated letter nearly brought things to a complete halt. Even an amateur conman would have done far better this. By far the most reasonable assumption is that Adamski was being his fumbling self and telling the truth as he saw it. Brian Treve observes that Adamski was somewhat relieved when he got his train to New York. In mid-1954, Desmond Leslie came to California to meet his co-author for the first time. In October he traveled to Detroit to meet the Reeves group. Bryant Reeve was impressed immediately by this fine, tall, cultured young Irishman. Leslie was grabbed quickly by radio station WWJ's Ross Mulholland, and again an electrifying live broadcast was made, some tapes of which still exist. Leslie then packed 1,200 folk into the largest auditorium of the Detroit Institute of Arts, and amused everyone with his witty tales of encounters with stiff British astronomers. He also raised smiles with his equally amusing tales about even stiffer English skeptics, whose essentially Victorian minds were still with Kitchener at Khartoum, as most of them still are. Too amusing as all true Irishmen are when speaking of the English, he described them as viewing anomalies as if they were hordes of the great unwashed about to break into the front parlour. Apparently he was also inspiring when he talked about how the English had no concept for the mysterious. All this of course required brilliant wit and sophisticated skill. Compared with Adamski's fumbling efforts, Leslie performed with a brilliant wit and sophistication that satisfied many doubters of the authenticity of the saucer phenomenon. In the course of this same lecture, the Sorcerer Royal, as the Reeves dubbed Leslie, talked about saucers being photographed during contemporary nuclear weapons tests, and he touched also upon areas of contemporary saucer interest, including topics which the definitely non-discursive Adamski rarely broached. In this sense Adamski lost out. He already had his theosophical Christian solution to the saucer phenomenon, and therefore talking about what went on in Hangar No. 27 of Muroc Air Base in any detailed modern analytic sense would have been as irrelevant to him as asking Jesus about the back of his left earlobe. Leslie was to meet the Reeves again a year later, when he lectured in Columbus, Ohio on October 26, 1955. There he gave the audience the latest saucer reports from Britain, including one very English account of a gardener being knocked off his bicycle by a saucer. Again, in the Leslie manner, he put the saucer problem in an historical perspective quite new to most American audiences. Says Brian Treve of Leslie, he brought out the point that if he had talked about television 100 years ago he probably would have been put in a straitjacket, 200 years ago he would have been burned at the stake for witchcraft. September 1, 1953. Adamski feels that great urgency again. The publication in Britain of Flying Saucers Have Landed is only weeks away, but he does not talk about how he looked forward to that event. No, he is back in the same Los Angeles hotel, a glutton for punishment. He dines out again with Firkin and Ranmu, but this time there is no apple pie, just sandwiches and coffee, and the jovial waiter is nowhere to be seen. They are served by a cordial waitress who interrupts only to fill their coffee cups. The coffee was certainly needed, for there is yet more consumer metaphysics about divine laws, the creator, and something called all knowledge. The content gets slightly more interesting however, because for the first time, Adamski asks hard questions about the death of Captain Mandel, a National Guard pilot who died chasing a UFO in his P-51 Mustang, degrees for instance. But Adamski gets some evasive answers. By the time he returns to his hotel he is now a junkie, and can't wait for his next fix of more religion, USA. Not long after this meeting, he is again traveling to Los Angeles, filled with joyous anticipation like a child before Christmas. But again there is the ominous note, now amplified. The mental communications from my friends of other planets were becoming more and more definite as time went on. Ramu greets him at the usual hotel. Firkin couldn't make it, and Ramu apologizes for him. Same Pontiac, same Saturnian scout ship, but this time, Ramu says that the visit has been requested by the Master himself, and that the whole of the trip will be not a tour, but a long session with the Master. In the face of this awesome prospect of another ball-breaking speech, Adamski must have been not a little relieved at meeting a posse of beautiful Saturnian women. But just as Ramu says there is quite a bit of activity on the part of your Air Force tonight, the Master arrives to break it all up. All of Adamski's masters have a serious problem. They must be amongst the most boring and crass-brained individuals ever born. This one in particular wouldn't make the ratings at a downtown Salvation Army bun for a prayer meeting just before the addicts and the drunks are thrown out and the cops are called. He is possessed by a kind of green blooming pond algae of the mind for which a sock on the jaw might have come as a relief to him and all concerned. Here he is in full flight, giving all earthlings the usual kicking. A great fallacy which has grown on the people of Earth is the custom of dividing into many parts that which should never be divided. You have multiple divisions in forms and teachings, many firm likes and dislikes, all of which serve only to add to the state of confusion on your planet. In other words, the Master does not like those wonderful conflicts, paradoxes and tragicomic catastrophes that alone make life worth living. His hostility to fuzzy-minded, hairy-assed humanity is a seamless piece of moral muzak. If this candy was produced by a higher intelligence, then it could be nothing more or less than a comic mimicking of Adamski's own religious philosophizing for the purpose of entertainment alone. These ruminations about the Earth, man, and the supreme intelligence come to an end with the kind of sentiment that has led the world to absolute disaster on countless occasions. Ramu, speaking of the Master, says, "He is one of the most evolved beings still functioning within our system. Just to be in his presence is to grow in love and understanding. We are all fortunate." Adamski asks Ramu if the Master contacted him telepathically and asked him to come along on this occasion. "Yes," answers Ramu, "your own ability to receive is growing. We now know how fortunate this growing ability was for Adamski, because eventually, these space chapel voices in his head were to almost destroy him, mentally, physically, and professionally. All these mighty confusions were, as we shall see, the stuff of personal tragedy involving interaction with the great visionary and technological." Almost a year later, August 23, 1954. The Last Contact. Flying Saucers Have Landed has now been published, and both Adamski and Desmond Leslie are in great demand. On this date, the visiting Desmond Leslie is away lecturing in Los Angeles. Adamski says that he tried to get Leslie aboard, but the Space Brothers wouldn't have him. What a disappointment for Leslie. He missed the farewell cake and the sexy dance, which made a wonderful change from impenetrable discussions about Universal Brotherhood, Holy Writ, and the Age of Aquarius. Unfortunately, on this trip the Master is back, and gives forth a blast about the right path. If this is enlightenment, then the Earth is in far greater danger than even Adamski ever thought. Another perfect Bogart scene. Adamski finds himself back in his lonely hotel room in deep withdrawal. This time the fix hasn't worked so well. The pushers are holding back and increasing their prices. There is a monkey is on his back, it won't go away, and the new world he has found is starting to eat him alive. We can hardly blame him. He was on the edge of an emerging cosmos where all events and significances were to become disposable, virtual, or hyperreal. Some 30 years later, Baudrillard describes well the Los Angeles to which Adamski traveled from his magic mountain to meet his spacemen and women. Los Angeles is a town whose mystery is precisely that it is nothing more than a network of endless unreal circulation, a town of fabulous proportions, but without space or dimensions. As much as electrical and nuclear power stations, as much as film studios, this town, which is nothing more than an immense script and a perpetual motion machine, needs this old imaginary makeup of childhood signals and fake phantasms for its sympathetic nervous system. And so, as Adamski leaves his metaphysical city, the story of these trips comes to an end. However, in an unexpected postscript at the end of Inside the Spaceships, Adamski makes a move straight out of Citizen Kane. He describes dashing into his publishers even as the presses are rolling on this book, possessed by yet another funny feeling. April 25, 1955. The frame of reference All Day Yesterday gives this whole episode the feeling of a surreal time sequence in a science fiction novel. Unable to sleep, Adamski tells us he caught a coach to Los Angeles, but this time he carried his own Polaroid camera, apparently with the space folks' prior permission. An unnamed brother he has not seen before greets him at the hotel, but warns him that the magnetic fields inside the spaceship might interfere drastically with the pictures. Once inside the ship, this brother takes the Polaroid, saying that he will take the pictures while Adamski has a chat with Orthon, who has appeared almost on cue. Three of the pictures taken with this camera appear in the British edition of Inside the Spaceships, published in 1956. What a story! And it has not been done. The life, the vision, and the contacts, neither film nor television makers have touched the confusions and the tragedy. Writing in 1970, Desmond Leslie comments, "George, damn it, I once expostulated. Do you swear by all that's sacred that you are telling the truth?" "Desmond," he answered quietly, "you know my religious beliefs. One of these days I shall have to face my maker. Do you think I'd dare face him with a lie like that on my conscience?" There was no doubting the man's sincerity. However, even telling Leslie that those guys were human just like you and me, on occasion Adamski would hedge his bets, if only to confuse, as was his way. When he last saw Leslie shortly before his death in 1965, he was still unwilling to admit anything other than a flesh and blood series of contacts. But Leslie does admit that on one occasion, Adamski said no one of us could be taken to another planet in our system and see the home world of its inhabitants in his present bodily form or condition. Much rich comedy has been provided over the years by many and varied attempts at constructing a single, elegant, unified solution to the UFO problem. Explanatory offerings have been as mad as anything Adamski had to offer. They range from Earth lights resulting from geomagnetic strain and electromagnetic pollution to J. Allen Hynek's swamp gas explanation for the 1966 UFO sightings over Michigan. The very British psychosocial explanations, now fortunately howled off the international stage, have been particularly hilarious. If we reverse the psychosocial equations, then we have a much better focus. Laboratory rats may not be the only creatures within an experimental maze. Certainly contact with an alien intelligence will rid us of all previous ideas of what intelligence is, and how it works. If we dismiss Adamski, it must be remembered that from his time onwards, the Western world became a huge doll's house, just like the inside of his spaceships, and gradually the entertainment media complex becoming integrated with the military-industrial complex. Those who scoff at the idea of fairy kingdoms might well consider that our own entertainment state is such a kingdom come about. Some cynics would say that the inside of the media entertainment head is identical to the interiors of Adamski's spaceships. Both are doll's house machines with plenty of blood around if we happen to open the wrong door. If there was such an alien invasion, it was a long time ago now, and it was silent, overwhelming, completely effective. It is still striking deep inland from its beachheads, and building new dolls for new walk-on parts in cyberspace. Through people like Adamski, invading agendas reached their targets, and the future was born. We don't have to be internet addicts to see agendas as pure disembodied information fields that are alien life forms in themselves. Adamski was in all likelihood seduced by a phenomenon that was pure manipulated suggestion. The kind of web-like information field that will replace eventually all pulleys, levers, and even our beloved electronic pulsations. His achievement is that he was one of the first to introduce the world to levels of post-industrial power as pure suggestion, performance, mimicking and virtual products, which last not more than a minute of old crankshaft time. In the sense that he introduced ideas of power and control as cool things and not old Hitler hot, he was a highly significant first modern. The age was changing in Adamski's head, and one such head is enough. Time in that sense exists in very few individuals. Like Yali of Melanesia, he was to be left marooned and confused, time dropped him and he could not complete his stories. But perhaps initiation of the first stories is sufficient. After that, the mission of such a manic information animal as Adamski is complete. His offspring were the eggs of a story virus. Death comes only when the story cycle has lodged within the host. then our teller of tales must go on to other story cycles beyond the sun and moon. Like Shakespeare, he leaves his fast-breeding stories behind as a form of immortality. Adamski created a permanent pan-dimensional masterwork, his books, his films, and his photographic collection. Seen as a whole, this complex is as good as any in the 20th century artistic portfolio. Just like his distant mentor, Charles Fort, Adamski's images serve as modern protective talismans against all solutions, singular or final, partial or elegant. He is a major constituent of the strange power of the UFO. Even young skeptics of a very different generation jump up and down like natives round a beating drum and take extreme counter-ritualizing measures against his very name. Meantime, contactees keep faith. They worship bits of very odd metal, unusual plastic, strange implants, and even a tasteless biscuit or two for similar protection against old industrial fact. Against the western twilight, they hold up these hosts and watch the sky. Chapter 12, The Subplot, Flying Saucer Pilgrimage. October 1954, Brian Treve took full retirement, and he set out with his wife Helen for Mexico. This was to be the first part of their Flying Saucer Pilgrimage, which was eventually to produce their book of that name. They contacted groups in the Mexico City area that had a saucer interest, and within a short time they became well known, appearing in newspapers, and on television. They even appeared for 2 minutes in a Luis Buñuel film of all things, Ensayo de un Crime, Rehearsal for a Crime. They were also elected charter members of the newly formed Mexican Society of Interplanetary Investigation. All this made them celebrities in Mexican eyes, aided by their known friendship with George Adamski and the publication of the Spanish translation of Flying Saucers Have Landed. The Reeves appeared on the television program Mesa de Celebridades, The Table of the Celebrities, to be questioned about Platillos Voladores, Flying Saucers. This was presented from the Roof Garden restaurant on top of the Continental Hotel in downtown Mexico City, and it was a primetime program watched by the cognoscenti and smart set of all Mexico. The astute Helen herself scored particularly well when asked about the possibility of the whole saucer business being a mass hallucination. She replied saying that if such a thing could happen, then would be a bigger mystery than the saucer business itself. Thus all was going well for the Reeves in Mexico until one day they picked up their mail and found a letter from none other than George Adamski himself. He said that he would be coming to Mexico for a vacation and rest on March 21, 1955, most probably because he had just completed / inside the spaceships. The sorcerers of the Mexican and English-speaking group duly met Adamski at the airport. Brian Treve says that Adamski's arrival was the beginning of a series of bizarre events that proved the old adage, anything can happen in Mexico. Some of these happenings so nearly resembled a fantastic light opera plot that even while they were occurring they seemed to us more like fiction than reality. As we all seemed to be playing parts in this amazing drama, we had to pinch ourselves at times to make sure we were really awake. On top of this Mexico effect, the Reeves also received in full the Adamski effect often observed by those who entered his orbit. Desmond Leslie was himself quite familiar with this effect. During Leslie's stay at Palomar, for example, there was hardly a dull moment, with many incidents straight from the pages of John Fowle's novel, The Magus. In the summer of 1954, Desmond Leslie visited Adamski and stayed at his house in Rincon Springs on Palomar Mountain. One evening, while walking nearby, Leslie says, I noticed a very bright ball of light rising from Adamski's roof, about a quarter of a mile away. It rose rapidly, rather like a silvery gold, very light, and continued to rise until it disappeared from sight. The following evening Leslie saw a similar effect while sitting on the patio with Adamski and Alice Wells. He felt at the time a curious cold feeling come over him, and he felt also that someone was behind him, and watching him closely. I swung round in time to see a small golden disc between us and the live oaks 50 feet away. Almost instantly it shot up in the air with an imperceptible swish, leaving a faint trail behind it, then vanished. George grinned solemnly. I was wondering when you were going to notice that I was amazed. Leslie has the same problem as Nicholas Earth in the Magus. The time-space equations do not quite fit the movement of ideas and materials, people and events. But then neither do normal space-time equations fit the physical schemes of the major American assassinations. Seeing such things, as he did with Adamski sitting beside him, Leslie, like Earth, might well have asked who was pulling the strings? Is Leslie a liar, or had Adamski himself rigged all the stage machinery required for these strange effects? Or are we on a kind of modern Prospero's Island, with the mechanical explanations far more fantastic than that they would seek to explain? Or are the explanations themselves a function of the deception? Luzenstag wrote of meeting Adamski in 1959, the few days I had spent with George had given me the insight that I was dealing with an extraordinary person. I already knew that there was another side to this man, a mystical one perhaps, and that there was probably another story to his story. We can understand what Zinstag is taking about when her Dutch friend Ray D'Aquila received in clear a telepathic test message sent by Adamski himself to all members of his Get Acquainted group. Apparently, in the Adamski style, the message was banal, and Zinstag is dismissive, but she does not seem at all impressed that it got there at all. This kind of definitely provable event was to dog Adamski all his life, baffling all but his most severe critics, who often got out of an embarrassing predicament by denying everything and anything. But just one of the problems in dealing with Adamski was the sheer number of high-quality reports coming in quite independently. The following statement by astronaut James McDivitt made in Omni magazine in 1980, is particularly significant. While a USAF jet pilot in 1951, he said that for several days in a row we sighted groups of metallic, saucer-shaped vehicles at great altitudes over the base, and we tried to get closer to them, but they were able to change direction faster than our fighters. I do believe that UFOs exist and that the truly unexplained ones are from some other technologically advanced civilization. The Mexican and English-speaking group planned the inevitable press conference, but made the mistake of using the Reeves apartment for this. Adamski was besieged, the apartment overflowed with reporters and photographers, and the event looked as if it was going to be a total success. However, it had been noticed by some members of the group that a certain number of reporters were not sympathetic at all. Fears were justified when the event got hardly any press coverage. While Bryant Reeve was organizing a conferencia for Adamski, he experienced the comedy of being mistaken for the great man himself. Helen Reeve had her own comic episode when she observed a group of influential Mexicans trying to get into a lift. They were anxious to meet Adamski, but the social and professional pecking order of entrance into 133 the lift had to be carefully organized. While this was being sorted out, the lift, of course, kept going up and down. The group of rather provincial Mexicans could not understand this motion, and they would be there to this day had not Helen ushered them all inside regardless. Similar Mexican practices prevailed at the conferencia. Apparently in Mexico, no speaker was ever allowed to continue for more than a few minutes. The result was a haze of quite impromptu comments and questions in both Mexican and English. Some of these interruptions were instantly translated into one or the other language, often by several over-enthusiastic members of the audience at once. Any apparent inaccuracies of translation became immediately points of loud multilingual contention. Adamski himself virtually disappeared in what became a massive internecine controversy, but he had better luck a short time later when he appeared at the Insurgente Theater, a world-famous mosaic mural created by the artist Diego Rivera adorned the front of the theater, and astonishingly, Rivera himself actually turned up for the event, which shows the kind of people Adamski managed to attract at this time. The pair had a conversation, and Adamski expressed his admiration of the mural. In the foyer was hung a long banner, Conferencia Los Platillos Voladores por George Adamski, and despite a lack of press coverage again, the group filled the large theater by word of mouth. They charged 5 pesos, then 40 cents in American money, for entrance to defray expenses, an action which would cause them much trouble later. Again, Adamski's lecture was interrupted when a television crew turned up and tried to film the event.